This is MSO News Sports. I'm Bill Newell, and we are joined by Paul Tucker, state representative from the city of Salem. And, Paul, great to be talking with you again.
Good morning, Bill. It's always a pleasure. Thank you. It's nice to get some information out to the listeners, so it's a pleasure. I appreciate the invitation to sit down and chat for a bit.
Yeah. Paul, you're one of the busiest state reps. You've been busy the last few weeks, and let's just start with the committees you are on. Just give me a quick list. I know we have unlimited time, so take your time in listing all these committees, and these are the big ones.
Sure. I guess if I had a favorite committee, it's the Judiciary Committee. The Judiciary Committee is known as probably the busiest committee. I'm honored that Speaker DeLeo put me on it. I did get a law degree in 2000, so that helps to be a member. I'm on my second term on the Education Committee, which has been a terrific committee to be on under Chairwoman Peisch, who's a representative from Wellesley. I'm on the Public Safety Committee, which has been my experience as a police officer for many, many years. I'm also on the Ways and Means Committee, which, again, is an honor. It's the final stop before bills get to the floor, particularly in money matters. I'm on the Ways and Means there. And I've just been elevated, and I'm grateful to Speaker DeLeo. I'm the vice chair now of the Marijuana Policy Committee. It's my first foray into chairmanship, so I'm a vice chair of marijuana, and obviously there's lots of work to do there as well. So a lot of work, a lot of committees, but every day I love it.
You wouldn't think a clean-shaven guy like you would be chairman, vice chair of the Marijuana Committee.
Well, I'll tell you, when they introduced me that now as the vice chair of marijuana, whatever crowd I'm in front, it does elicit a few chuckles, I have to tell you that. I've seen the reaction, much different than being introduced as a member of the Education Committee.
Exactly. All right. Well, we can follow up on that. But I know that, you know, I talked with Brendan Crichton a few days ago, and Brendan was brought up criminal justice reform. So this is huge. You're right in the middle of this, and you mentioned your years as a police officer, police chief in Salem. So where are we at with criminal justice? What are the elements that you guys are looking at the State House?
So right now, the House, we've passed our version of an omnibus bill, which is it's an extraordinary bill, and I'm very proud to have played at least a small part of it as a member of the Judiciary Committee, and that's where this bill actually came from. The Senate has also passed their own version, and there are some marked differences between the two. So early last week, conference committees were named from the House and the Senate. There'll be three members of the House of Representatives, three members of the Senate, and they are tasked with sitting down together to reconcile the differences. And there's some really good people, very good, committed, dedicated people on both sides on the House and the Senate. I'm very confident that sometime in early or mid-January, that a nice, comprehensive bill that's smart on crime, efficient on crime, and also takes into account what we can do for getting people back into society for reintegration. I'm very confident that a good bill will land on Governor Baker's desk sometime in early or mid-January.
I know I actually watched a television story a week or so ago. It might have been on Channel 5. I'm not sure which one it was. But it was about a culinary program at the Concord MCI prison there. And it's just a natural that you would have something like that. But they have a restaurant there. And it's just for reintegration of inmates back into the workforce.
One of the most important things that we need to do, Bill, is give ex-offenders every safety net to put them on a path to success. I'm familiar with the program at Concord. I've taken a tour of the prison at Shirley, seen some of the things they're doing there. I've taken several tours with Sheriff Carpenter up at the Essex County facility. And a big piece of this criminal justice reform bill has to do with record reform. It has to do with data analytics, and it has to do with making sure that we keep what we call the recidivism rate, which is the rate that people reoffend. We want that as low as possible. Ideally, we'd love to get it down to zero. We know that's probably not realistic, but if we can keep that number very, very low for people that made a mistake, give them the opportunity to succeed, society is better off, society is safer, and the individuals are on the path to success.
You've covered, kind of in a broad brush, so many different areas. But if you, as you know, with your expertise as as a former police chief in Salem and now on this committee, what would you say if you could do one quick fix? What would the most important thing be? And again, I know you're not eliminating any other stuff.
Yeah, I think it would be to put programming in place which would take a look to see what folks are suffering from, whether it's opiate addiction, some degree of mental illness, the need for job skills, some type of emotional treatment. If we could get the analytics on that and then put the best programming in place with programs that are ready to go when somebody steps out of the facility and into society to give them the best path to success. We know about the punishment piece. We know about the court piece. To me, the last piece, and particularly with the men and women, young men and women, and then all demographics, older folks, the opiate epidemic that has touched so many lives, if I could fix one thing with the magic wand, it would be to address in a very comprehensive way to get those folks back on their feet on a path to success.
Yeah. So much stuff, and it's been a big transformation in a sense when you look at prisons. Initially, the mindset was, and this goes way back, I get this piece, but it was how many months, how many years. That was it, right? I mean, yeah. At one point, a long time ago.
Yeah, and it really turned into what we call warehousing. And, you know, there's been various cycles. If we go look through in the not-too-recent past from the 1960s forward, we tried being rehabilitation experts. And then in the 1980s, particularly around what we know now as the crack epidemic in the mid-1980s, we saw a tremendously bad spike in crime, and politicians were looking for worse punishment. Let's make it hard. I remember Governor Weld at the time said, let's introduce these inmates to the joys of busting rocks, kind of evoking the chain gang. None of that was right. And I can tell you in my career, we spent an awful lot of money, time, and resources on the law enforcement piece to the exclusion, unfortunately, of the treatment and rehabilitation piece. But I'm happy to say that as we sit here now, the three-legged stool really of enforcement, education, and treatment, I think in equal parts, I'd like to say that the legislature has done a very, very good, efficient job. Kudos to Governor Baker, who's done tremendous work in this area as well. I think we're all on the same page now, knowing that the failures can't be repeated and looking for what we can build successes on.
Gotcha. We're talking with State Representative Paul Tucker from Salem here with us here on MSO News Sports. Anything new on gun regulations and what's taking place on Beacon Hill?
There's a few big things going on right now. The listeners may recall about a year or so ago, our Attorney General, Maura Healey, put down a directive where she wanted to crack down on what's so-called these duplicate weapons or mimicking weapons. In Massachusetts, we had a ban on a number of weapons, such as assault rifles. And what some of the manufacturers did was took the specifications of the rifles that were banned, and they changed some of the specs. And there is a real question now, and it's actually before the Supreme Judicial Court. There's two parts to it. Number one, did the Attorney General have the right to do what she did unilaterally, or should it have been done through legislation? And two, if she did, does that ban actually hold where these so-called copycat weapons actually can be now subject to the original legislation? I've gotten, I'm going to say, over 1,000 emails from people on both sides of the issue. Guns in the Second Amendment are one of those issues, one of a handful that really get the passion going. And to me, it makes for a robust discussion. We are waiting for the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts to make their ruling, and then we'll have to go from there.
Did Massachusetts pass that bum stocks bill, the one that came out of the Las Vegas shooting?
We did. And interestingly enough, even most of my colleagues who are extremely strong Second Amendment supporters, with the exception, I believe, of three members in the legislature, we overwhelmingly passed in fairly short order the ban on bump stocks. And as you correctly said, that was the mechanism that allowed the Las Vegas shooter to fire so many rounds in such a short period of time. It's my understanding, reading from news accounts, that even the National Rifle Association said, look, we're not going to endorse a ban, but at least we're willing to talk about it. Locally in Massachusetts, we have a group called the Gun Owners Action League. The executive director, Jim Wallace, I found them to be very reasonable. We may disagree on some points, but I find them always willing to engage in a very healthy discussion, and I think that can only help.
Yeah. You know, looking nationally now, there's a bill, I think, in the House, right, that just passed in the U.S. House about these the concealed weapons going from state to state, which to me would take away the power, the legislation of a particular state regarding concealed weapons, which, and I can't see that going anywhere, but who knows?
So it's my understanding that the House did pass that. The bill is called reciprocity, and it would allow somebody who's licensed in one state to lawfully carry in a different state. Here's the issue. Massachusetts has arguably the toughest gun laws. Some states, particularly some from the western states, and even a couple in New England, their concealed carry laws are much, much different. They're much more relaxed. I think that's problematic. I understand where the gun owners are coming from, but in terms of a state's ability to control their own lawful carry, I think that many states are not willing to cede that authority to a national legislation. So although it did pass the House, it's my understanding that it's going to have a very bumpy road in the Senate. So what looks like the bill in the House, if it's passed at all in the Senate, may look very different.
Yeah, I agree with you on looking at the politics of it in the Senate. That's probably the case. That's my guess. All right, let's go to education. Yep. So many things in education. And I know a topic that has come up, it was big 20 years ago, maybe, ELL, English Language Learners, and what's new there?
So we actually have what I consider to be excellent news. And as you correctly said, Bill, it was about 20 or 22 years ago when there was a movement that swept the country for so-called English immersion, that if it was an English language learner was coming from a different country, spoke a different language, the idea at the time in the early 90s, let's immerse that student and let them learn all the topics in this new language, English, in the U.S. It's been found to be about an 80 to 85% failure rate. My take on it is this. Math is hard enough to learn in your native language. How do you then add another layer on top of that of trying to learn that topic in a language that you're not a native speaker? So last week, Governor Baker signed a bill, and what it actually has two very good parts to it. We no longer are going to do this so-called English immersion. It's going to allow school districts some flexibility to teach children in their native language while learning English at the second as a secondary language. It also puts forth something that I had been working on behalf of, something called the Seal of Biliteracy, which I'm very excited about. If somebody has shown a proficiency in a second language, for instance, an English language first speaker learns Latin or Spanish or French, and they demonstrate a proficiency on several levels, including a national test, on their diploma, they will be able to get a seal on their diploma showing that they are proficient in a second language. And in today's world, a lot of what I tell my students, I teach a class at Salem State and at North Shore, is particularly in the job market, how do you separate yourself from a job that 30 or 40 or 50 people may be going for? And I always see in the top one or two prospects of jobs that if you can speak a second language, you've shown a proficiency to learn, you also become a much more valuable employee. I can tell you as police chief in Salem, in my 5 years, we did great outreach to the Latino community. We were looking for offices of Hispanic heritage, and in particular, offices that were bilingual. We wanted our department to look like the community, and very importantly, we wanted to make sure we had offices that could communicate, particularly in emergency situations. Somebody that spoke a second language, it's difficult enough in policing sometimes for an English-speaking person speaking to an English-speaking officer in a time of distress. So to me, that seal of biliteracy is a perfect example that public safety, police, fire, and EMS may want to put down as a preferred method of hiring someone.
No, I think it's a great idea, too, and I would tell my students, too. I mean, when you look at the jobs or you go different places, especially when you're dealing with the public, having that second language is now almost you have to have it in many places.
You really do. And, you know, we live in a global world, and we and just in our city alone in Salem, we have a very diverse culture. I forget the number of different languages spoken, but it's over 20. And to me, that adds to the vibrancy. And if somebody is speaking a second language, I just think it makes us socially and culturally better than not having it as well.
Any other education issues? We touched on the ELL piece here. Anything else that's coming up?
I think that the charter school issue may bubble up a little bit more. We don't have much in front of us this term because the ballot question settled some of it. But there's a little talk about it again. The second piece that has come back again this year is the so-called high-stakes testing. Whether it's the MCAS or the PARC, there are a number of educators that feel that we should take a second look at this testing. That would, you know, that we've heard the criticism, teachers are teaching to the test, it's taking up too much time. You know, we should be going back. There was a bill that was filed to mandate teaching civics. The school day is only so long. I'm a big fan of teachers. I'm a public school kid. We're blessed in Salem to have a phenomenal teaching corps. So we're still going back and forth on that now. There is a live bill before us for either what's called a moratorium on these tests or to do away with the high-stakes testing. I'm not sure that we're going to take some definitive action this term, but it's still in the mix for discussion.
We're talking with State Representative Paul Tucker from Salem here with us here on MSO News Sports. Let's breeze through a couple of other topics here. Another committee you're on, as we talked about at the beginning, Ways and Means. That's a big one. That involves all the money and all those issues. And right now, I understand that you guys are getting some good economic news for the state.
Yes, we actually had our first hearing yesterday on what's called revenue consensus. And it's my first time around doing the budget on Ways and Means. And for me personally, it was a fascinating exercise in seeing what's the forecast, how much money can we expect, and where can we start to think about prioritizing. So we had some of the state officials in yesterday. We had Mass Taxpayers Foundation. We had a couple of economists. And for me, not having a background in this, I found it fascinating. We did get some good news. Right now, the revenue collection, we're running a couple of $100 million above what's called the benchmarks that we want to hit. If we continue at this pace, I think it can only help. We want to make sure that we have money put away for the so-called rainy day fund. I am extremely impressed by the way our new chairman, Jeff Sanchez, chair of Ways and Means, who took over for another great chair, Brian Dempsey from Haverhill, who I've never met anybody that knew the budget inside and out like Chairman Dempsey, but Chairman Sanchez has now stepped right in. So with this revenue consensus, it begins the discussion to see what we need to do to prioritize for the next fiscal year. And we just got that kicked off yesterday.
Well, I always like to hear some good news around this at any time of the year, actually. Now, ballot questions. What do you know about possible ballot questions that voters will see in November?
Well, there's a few that have been going through the process of being certified. One of which is to raise the minimum wage to $15. Now, there is a passionate discussion on both sides, and I'll briefly tell you each side. There are folks that are working minimum wage jobs. They may have a family. They're facing rising costs that we all know, housing, everything else that is the cost of living, and they are looking to raise this to $15 an hour. They are calling it a living wage. On the other side of the coin, Retailers Association of Mass, they have a very strong leader in John Hurst, who's a Beverly resident, and John makes a very strong case that what do we do with the small retail operations, the small businesses, the ice cream stands, the variety stores, people who are making their profits but are on a very slim margin. Are we going to pay high school kids that come in to work part-time at some of our markets? I know we've got great Crosby's Market, for instance. Jim Crosby does a phenomenal job, hires a lot of young men and women, hires a lot of folks with special needs. The argument is that if this minimum wage goes to $15 an hour, are we going to lose part of the workforce in a time now where unemployment is in the high 3 or low 4%, which is phenomenal. So I see both sides of it. I'd like to see some type of a middle ground, and I'm not quite sure what that looks like yet, but if there is some type of a sliding scale wage, maybe there's a teen wage, maybe there's a seasonal wage, I'd like to see us all get around the table and have that discussion. We certainly want to make sure that people earn a living wage, but we also have to make sure that we honor and respect the concerns that the folks in the retail shops have.
Yeah, I would have to say that I think a compromise would make a lot of sense. In other words, you know, you want to reward businesses that do exactly what you talked about, what Jim Crosby is doing at Crosby's Market, and there's hundreds of them, you know. And yet, on the other hand, there are a lot of businesses, I'm thinking, that do depend on these workers that, you know, they're working moms or whatever, and they're 30 years old, 40 years, whatever they are. And maybe they do. Maybe there is certainly some room to kick those wages up.
I think so too, and that really respects the whole spectrum. Whether it's somebody that's, you know, 16 years old that's working a part-time job, or somebody that has young children, and we really have to find a way to do right by everybody here. We certainly don't want to hurt businesses. Businesses are the lifeblood, particularly small businesses, and they're facing enough challenges. We know with the online purchases. Cyber Monday of last week, staggering amount of money that people spent buying online, and we see the packages that are delivered, particularly in the Christmas season. We need to make sure that we respect and understand the concerns of the retailers as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Again, other ballot questions. Millionaires tax, is that a possibility?
Yes.
I'm kind of out of that one. I'm not too worried about that one, but tell me about it.
So over the last two terms.
I say go for it.
It won't have any impact.
Yeah.
Over the last two terms in the House, we held what's called a constitutional convention, and we voted not to approve the millionaires tax, but to put it on the ballot. So let me explain what it is, and then I can tell you what the procedure is. Right now, we pay a little over 5% income tax in Massachusetts, and everybody pays it. It's across the board. Doesn't matter how much you earn. So what Chair Kaufman from the Revenue Committee had proposed and now has passed two terms is there was a majority of members that voted to put it on the ballot. Let the people have a say. So here's how it would work. Anybody, not the value of your portfolio, not your net worth, strictly in terms of yearly wages. If your yearly wage is over $1 million, you would be taxed for the first million at that 5.5% like everybody else. And then for anything over $1 million, you would be taxed at an additional 4%. One of the forecasters yesterday told us that if that passes, would raise about $1.2 billion annually. Now, there's also a caveat to it. That money does not just go into the general fund. That money has to specifically be targeted for only one of two things, transportation or education. And the reason why transportation is in there, people may recall there was a 3-cent gas tax that was contemplated, and that was prior to me coming into the legislature, and the citizens voted it down. That money was going to specifically go into infrastructure for transportation. There isn't a day that goes by, Bill, where I don't get complaints about the T, the service, you know, that just there's a host of issues that the commuters that I'm speaking to now in the listening audience, they know what I'm talking about. There's been a lot of work that's trying to get some infrastructure improvements done there. On the education piece, we know that there's things we can do if we had more resources. So if this bill passes, and it's going to go to the ballot question, so the people will have their say, that $1.2 billion that are forecasted specifically for transportation and education. So let's see if it passes.
Yeah. The other one that I remember hearing about would be the income tax rollback question back to 5%. Is that on the ballot for November?
I believe that one is being studied right now. Attorney General Mara Healey, they have to check the signatures, then they have to check the language of it. I know that the Retailers Association of Mass, that they want to roll that back to 5.05%, just a shade over 5%. And there is some concerns about that, frankly, that any time that there's a cut, there is a consequence. For every action, there's a reaction. And I can tell you that one of the things that I've paid particular attention to in my now 3 years in the legislature is trying to prioritize. We've got folks on the margins. We have one of the things I work on almost every day is issues of homelessness. People that are couch surfing. I know that at North Shore Community College, they took a survey, and fully one-third of the students described themselves as homeless, living in a car, or couch surfing, or just crashing at a friend's house. That's unacceptable in today's society. I know in Salem, the waiting list for public housing is over 1,000 people long. people are waiting, and the need for housing is only growing. It's not getting any smaller. So anytime that we talk about cuts, it's going to impact some people significantly. And our job, as I see it, in the House and the Senate and the governor and his staff, is to make sure that we get the resources to the people that need them.
Yeah, that project at North Shore Community College was a great research job to point, to point that issue out to obviously the college, but obviously it has bigger ramifications than just that. I want to come full circle back to the city of Salem. This past November, it appeared from the outside that it was a relatively contentious race for mayor, other races out in the city of Lynn. So it's all settled down. Mayor Driscoll's been reelected. What's the situation in the city of Salem?
Well, the bottom line is, as it should be, Bill, in democracy, the people have spoken. And I commend Mayor Driscoll for a resounding victory. I also commend her for the many years that she has put into the city of Salem. I also commend Paul Prevey. I worked very closely with Paul when he was a city councilor during his four terms. Paul had a particular affinity for law enforcement. His dad, growing up when Paul was in North Adams, his dad was a lifelong law enforcement guy, a police officer for over three decades. This gave the people of Salem a real choice. Paul presented his vision. Mayor Driscoll presented her vision, and the people have spoken, and it's time to move on. We've had a few changes on the city council. The election this year, of course, was against the backdrop of the ballot question, which was sanctuary cities, and it was contentious. It was a robust debate, I'll say, and there was much passion on both sides. Again, the people have spoken. It passed by over 1,700 votes. And now it's up to the city and the officials to implement it, much as we do with any other ballot question that passes, to do it smartly, efficiently, and in a way that carries out the intent of the voters.
I love how you put the positive spin, and I'll use the air quotes, robust debate on several of these things that we've talked about today. Let me wrap up with one last question. Sanctuary cities is also a Beacon Hill issue, too, as well, or sanctuary legislation. Is there something happening there?
Right now, that bill is in the Public Safety Committee, which I sit on. We took a full day's worth of testimony. The bill that's pending at the state level is a little different than the bill that Salem passed, although they may claim the same name of sanctuary. There are a few parts of the state bill that I had some concerns about, which I raised to the sponsor, Rep. Juana Matias from Lawrence, who's a terrific first-term legislator. Hardworking attorney, brought a great deal of expertise. So Rep. Matias, she's been working very hard on it. Some of the concerns I've heard are around the cooperation between law enforcement authorities at the federal, state, and local level, make sure that's intact. And the other big piece, honestly, Bill, is the concern that a lot of people have that the legislature mandates top-down, that they issue the order from Boston that goes out to small cities and towns. There is no small group of folks that say, look, why doesn't the state put a template out and allow cities and towns to opt in? I know that there's a few towns out around Worcester where virtually the entire population is against this. And there's been, unfortunately, some high-profile tragedies involving undocumented immigrants, and that galvanized a number of people in those communities. So there's a real concern about a top-down ordering cities and towns that they must do this. I expect a lot more of the so-called robust debate, and I think more to come on that. I think that one of the things that, and I'll finish on that topic with this, one of the things I think we do right in Massachusetts, we take our time, we have thoughtful discussion, we have great debate inside the House, and by the time we pass legislation, I think we get it right. It's better than rushing something through. The sanctuary bill, this is the first time this has been filed, to my knowledge. I want to make sure that if we do something, and that's a big if, let's make sure we get it right.
Great. Great information. Great talking with you, Representative Tucker. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Bill. And to the listeners, happy holidays. Great new year upcoming. Always a season of Thanksgiving and optimism. And I'm optimistic for the next year ahead.
Yeah. 2018. Unbelievable. Yep. Wow. State Representative Paul Tucker from the City of Salem with us here. I'm Bill Newell, and this is MSO News Sports.